Hi, my name is Michael Creamer, and welcome to another podcast which is focused on the world of corporate real estate and anything that touches it. Today, I'm talking to Manish Datta, who's a director at the UK Green Building Council, as well as a fellow at the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. So we're going to be spending a good 20 minutes talking about the world of sustainability and how that touches property. Nice to have you on the podcast, Manish.
Very humbled to be invited to share some thoughts with you, Michael. And I've really enjoyed listening to this series. It offers some brilliant insights. So thank you. And congratulations on achieving 30 episodes and 28,000 listens. Amazing.
Thank you. Nice piece of PR for me. Appreciate it. No, and they're fun and they're interesting and they certainly seem to be resonating. So maybe before we get into the property side of this, can you just maybe give us a little bit of insight into how you got into the whole kind of world of sustainability?
Sure. So it should really start with Marks & Spencer, because I spent 21 wonderful years at Marks & Spencer. And for most of it, I led the development and delivery of Marks & Spencer's sustainability strategy called Plan A for its global property portfolio. But I suppose the moment of personal sustainability epiphany, if you want, came to me when I learned I was about to become a father in 2007. And that moment sort of immediately made me measure time very differently and much more broadly, perhaps through the eyes of my newborn son, as opposed to through my own eyes. And it forced me to look back at how much the world had changed in the 30 years since I was his age and how much it may change when he becomes my age. I'm of Indian origin. I was born in Africa, and I had the great privilege in my childhood of being immersed in nature in the game reserves of Masai Mara or by the Indian Ocean in Mombasa. But since that time, and when I was staring at my son in my arms as he was just born, nature had changed a great deal. There were not as many butterflies or bees in our garden, for example. The taste of fruit had changed. The air was definitely not as fresh. So essentially that sort of 60-year past and futurescaping scared the hell out of me. And around that time, it was my great fortune that Marks & Spencer conceived its pioneering sustainability program, Plan A. And I found a way of becoming involved in it. And ultimately led cross-business teams to design and deliver M&S's strategy, which led to some amazing results. You know, 40% reduction in energy use, 28% reduction in carbon. We adopted renewables 100% for our UK and Irish estate in 2012, went zero waste to landfill around the same time. And all of that combined also enabled us to save around £200 million. And it was thanks to Marks & Spencer and my son, I guess, that I became interested in my career in sustainability, and then gave me the opportunity to use the Marks & Spencer case study to share and learn from others via organisations like the University of Cambridge Institute of Sustainability Leadership and UK Green Building Council, which is where I work now. So that's kind of how I fell into sustainability. You have my son to blame for that.
It's a lovely story. And I'm sure we could talk for hours about where you grew up as well. That sounds fascinating. And the Marks & Spencer story, I remember distinctly, and it was one of the first British corporates to really focus on this. And then you moved from there to the UK Green Building Council. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what is that set up to do? What is it doing? What have you sort of seen change maybe over the last couple of years? And now obviously as sustainability becomes more and more on everyone's radar, so to say.
Yeah, sure. So UK GBC, I'll abbreviate just for time, is a really small and influential charity where I'm responsible for leading membership strategy for its 500 predominantly business, some government and academic members. And I've got overall responsibility to make sure that our members get great value from UK Green Building Council, and also have some responsibility for finance, people and operational functions. And our mission at GBC is to radically improve the sustainability of the built environment by transforming every part of its value chain. So the way it's planned, the way it's designed, the way it's funded and invested in, the way it's constructed on site, the way it's occupied and maintained, and ultimately as it gets repurposed, all of that all over again in the new life cycle. And we essentially collaborate to advocate, to enable, to inspire accelerated leadership in action, as I said, mainly with business and with government on things like climate change, resource use, nature and biodiversity, health and well-being, and ultimately, when you round all of that up, the socioeconomic impact that buildings, spaces, cities create. And it's my great pleasure to say that Cushman & Wakefield have been a member of UK Green Building Council for many years. And aside from being grateful for your support, we also are encouraging all of you and all of our members to join us in that mission that I've described and to really, really change the sector as a whole. So your question is, what's happened, I suppose, recently? Because it feels, doesn't it, in the last 12 months that business has changed and sustainability has gone up the agenda. Well, let me add to that to say the last 12 months have probably been our busiest and most impactful ever at UKGBC. Our membership's grown by 16% in that time. And last week we announced that it crossed the 500 member threshold for the very first time in our history. And history is an important context because for the first 12 years of UKGBC's life, I should say we were formed in 2007. And for the first 12 years of that, roughly, we focused on convincing our members about their environmental, moral and social, financial responsibility to change. And the fact that the built environment was at the very heart of the sort of climate crisis. And we were building a case for that. So I was trying to answer the question why. But what's happened in the last 12 months has been quite remarkable, perhaps because we've considered the existential threats from a virus. It has made us a little bit more aware about bigger existential threats from perhaps climate and ecological challenges that we face. And what we've found in the last 12 months, especially, is more than ever that civil society, business and government are calling and demanding and showing greater action on climate change. And if we just take, break those down, let's take the government point of view. It's, of course, been very focused on mitigating the effects of COVID-19. And it may have been tempting for government to put the climate agenda on hold, but we've seen quite the opposite. We've seen that government is seeing that the economic recovery can occur simultaneously and, more importantly, can be stimulated by the green economy right at the very heart of it. And our members are realising that now is the time to act and demonstrate leadership to be resilient in the future. So we're seeing, from our membership, stronger than ever commitments on sustainability, a greater than ever hunger to upskill, and actually a stark realization perhaps that as well as mitigating the risk from inaction, there is a huge opportunity to harness benefit from proactive action. And members are seeing increasing interest, business members are seeing increasing interest from their investors. They're seeing increasing legislation changes from government. They're seeing their customers being more demanding around this, and indeed their employees asking quite tough questions of them. And I think what COVID has done in the last 12 months has transitioned what was a building interest into active participation. And I'd go further and say almost activism or demand for change.
Wow. So, that's fascinating. And what you said, which I really like, is the fact that every stakeholder, let's say, is involved now, which I'm sure hasn't always been the case. So if I link that back to your experience at Marks and Spencer's, which I believe at the time was certainly at the forefront of this and one of the first to consider its carbon footprint, let's say, within the Green Building Council, are you seeing the corporate occupiers, the likes of Marks and Spencer's and the other large companies really ramping up their involvement in this sustainability crisis that we're all facing?
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes, Michael. If 2020 was the year when realization perhaps turned to commitment and perhaps storytelling to some extent, i.e., before not recognizing the story, but now starting to tell it, then in the corporate world, 2021 is promising to be the year of action and story doing. And COP26 in Glasgow in autumn of this year gives UK PLC a massive opportunity to showcase the incredible climate action and indeed solutions UK PLC can provide to the world. Our economy needs this stimulus more than ever. We need to bring our society together more than ever. Our planet and ecology needs this regeneration more than ever. So transitioning to a more sustainable way of working, living, playing is probably our best chance of achieving all of those objectives. And I think UK PLC, UK corporate world, is right at the very heart of that. And what we need and what we're encouraging our members to now turn to, having sort of gone through a period of realization and now advocacy, is to move to action and to share the evidence of their success, be it environmental, social, or economic. And actually, we've got some form on this, Michael. This, you know, we should be inspired by what's already happened. And I was reading in the World Economic Forum website this morning a really great article that since 2014, global renewable energy capacity has grown by 50%. In the UK, sales of meat substitutes by 85%. Global electric car stocks have grown by 900%. And sustainable debt issuance by more than 1,000%. But these are from relatively small starting points and incremental in the context of these markets. What we need to see now in 21, driven by the corporate world, is changing these markets completely and moving from incremental to completely monumental and systemic. And I think that's the great promise. And I've got great hope from the corporate world that that's going to happen.
So let's maybe dig into that a bit more, because I think, you know, everything that you're talking about, as you say, it's coming from a low base, but it resonates. It seems to be that there's more and more interest. I certainly know that from a corporate point of view, more and more of the businesses are saying they need to be carbon net zero. They want to follow the Paris Accord. Can you just talk, maybe explain what we mean by net zero and carbon accord, and what it is you think that these occupiers and users of space can be doing?
Sure. So perhaps it's important to contextualize that first. So given its impact, the built environment is so central to the UK and global efforts to remain below that 1.5 degree Paris agreed global warming threshold. And that's the point. It was 2 degrees actually technically in Paris, but that's been revised since to 1.5 degrees with greater scientific knowledge and evidence. And that threshold is the point at which, after which, if we don't keep global warming below that 1.5 threshold, after that, the challenges we face and the disruption we face to our natural, ecological, economic, societal systems can be irrecoverable. So that's a really important threshold. And the fact is that the built environment is at the very heart of keeping our global emissions below that threshold and our warming below that threshold. They're effectively the gatekeepers of half of all greenhouse gas emissions globally. So net zero carbon is really critical within that. And in essence, our net zero carbon means that we're calling on our members, businesses, organizations at cities, states, regions to reach that net zero operating emissions target by 2050. And there's a whole framework that we've developed to enable at the UKGBC by UKGBC members to enable organizations to sort of go through that net zero carbon journey. And you're now seeing lots and lots of organizations based on that framework and other frameworks issue what they're calling net zero pathways on how they can, through reduction in energy use, through the procurement of renewable energy, through then, if required, the balance coming from good quality, ethical and offsets which have integrity, reach that net zero status for their own emissions and, more critically, for their sort of clients, what called scope 3 emissions, and also looking at embodied emissions. And what I mean by that is the energy required to create materials. And in the built environment, that would be the energy required to create materials that a building's made out of, for example.
Let me cut across, because I just want to make sure we're digging even further into that. So I'm interested to hear a little bit more from you about exactly that point, the materials. And we were talking sort of off air, so to say, beforehand about what I thought was a fascinating idea from the European Commission president, Ursula von der Leyen, who talks about this need for a European Bauhaus. And I think what she's suggesting is that we need an architectural movement. And this article that I read talks about this. It says, today it is the climate transition that demands new materials, construction processes, and planning for changing lifestyles. So can you talk a little bit about what is meant there by new materials and construction processes?
Sure. I mean, at the starting point, Michael, is that we are quite a wasteful industry. So we are quite wasteful in the way we create buildings. We're quite wasteful in the way we use buildings. And we can use technology to really help us with that. So there are some really interesting technology solutions out there now quite well established, such as building information modeling, which enables you to effectively virtually design a building. And if you mix that with virtual reality, actually, you know, see the building and walk around the building way before it goes anywhere near a site to be put up. When you can do that, then you can then decide how you want to create the building. You can decide the kind of materials and the carbon footprint of those materials in creating the building. There's so much data available now where you can virtually create the building and know how much carbon you will have used up in the creation of the building, and indeed predict more and more accurately how much carbon you will use in the operation of that building.
So you could say, for instance, you could design the building using, what, let's say, pre-COVID or pre-sustainability discussions, materials, concrete, glass, steel, and then you could also design it with, let's say, from timber, and you could see what the difference in what you referred to earlier is embedded carbon and other things are. Is that?
You can, and you must. We must take a sort of whole life view on this as well. So, you know, that's why I talk about wastefulness, both in terms of the way we create buildings, but also the way we use buildings and reuse buildings. So, yes, there are some materials that have a lower upfront carbon impact, but then we must also understand how we may reuse those materials for the whole life of that building. And we must consider what the life of that building is. You know, creating buildings for just a mono use, I think is incredibly wasteful. In fact, I'd go as far as saying 50% of the buildings that we have in the world, especially in the developed economy, are underutilized by a factor of 50%. So 100% buildings are underutilized by a factor of 50%. And what I mean by that is half the time, nearly all the buildings that we have are not used. Right. That can't be right. That's an awful use of resources. So how can we use these smart design, utilization to make sure that we get most return from whatever investment we're making, financial and indeed from a resource point of view, natural resources, et cetera, et cetera. How do we make sure that we use them more efficiently? There's a convergence of biomaterials, technology, smart ways of creating things and how we use them that is going to enable us to be much more efficient. I think that's what the commissioner was talking about.
Fascinating. We could talk about how we measure and so on as well. But one of the other things that you and I talked about beforehand was this, the whole issue of diversity and inclusion. And I know you've got some thoughts and views on that. Can you maybe just briefly outline what those are?
Yeah, of course. So at the time we were grappling with this pandemic, the issues that, and frankly, the murder that we saw of George Floyd, which actually gave a new sense of awareness for everyone around the issues of discrimination based on race, and indeed things like the Black Lives Movement, has kind of started me personally and many people, I'm sure, starting to question whether or not we are doing enough on inclusion and diversity. And in fact, there has been a long-standing discussion that climate change is also seen as an inequality issue on a global level. Those parts of the world who have contributed least to historic carbon emissions, very, very tragically, will be the most affected by climate change and also be the least able to adapt themselves to those effects as well. If you bring it back to the UK, there are some really, really startling data around some perhaps systemic issues. So in 2017, the think tank Policy Exchange attempted to measure the extent of ethnic diversity across occupations in England and Wales. And they found that ethnic diversity has been unevenly distributed across different sectors. And in the environmental or sustainability sector, we were the second least diverse profession in the UK. Only 3% of environmental professionals identify themselves as minorities, compared to an average of nearly 20% of all other occupations. And then if you look at the built environment sector or the property sector in the UK, and let's just look at BAME metrics, 14% of the UK's population classifies itself as a BAME, coming from BAME origin, but only 1.2% of the built environment sector is from the same origin. So looking at this data and prompted perhaps by the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests, we've all been asking ourselves some big questions and feel quite, I personally at times have felt quite conflicted by this. I haven't experienced any racism or injustice personally, or have I been conditioned by the system around me to ignore it, to become immune to it, to fight through it and not let it affect me? And what should I do about it now that I have this awareness? Where should I stand on it? Where do the people I work with stand on it? What, you know, it's a really tricky subject that hasn't really benefited from any open conversations. So we are working at UK Green Building Council and indeed at the university to look at these issues, to look at every part of our operation, every part of our advocacy, every part of our steering group composition, the composition of our boards, of our teams, of our content, to look at, you know, what do we do about this? How far can we go with this? How can we mobilize business to think differently around and to become more inclusive and more diverse? And so that's kind of what we've been working on these kinds of issues recently. And they can't be solved singularly. You know, the reason why we're in this, I suppose, situation now is that we've tried to do them singularly. We need to do them to deal with these issues collaboratively on an unprecedented scale and very quickly in order to solve them.
Fascinating. And as you say, there's an awfully long way to go. I guess the good news is that you're beginning, but there's a lot of things going on that will help. You know, in terms of sort of wrapping up the conversation, I'm not sure how you'd like to do this, but maybe how do you wrap those last thoughts around diversity inclusion into this whole need for the corporate agenda to continue to shift so that we tackle this whole idea of sustainability, climate change, you know, more quickly than we are now, although I appreciate you said it's improved. But is there a way you can kind of pull those pieces together, do you think?
That's become really tangible about it. And talk about real estate and talk about probably less commercial real estate and more sort of residential real estate. And if you look at the carbon challenge that we've got in terms of net zero, the biggest challenge remains in homes. Mm. And if you look at the homes which are most carbon leaking or the poorest quality from a carbon performance, they also tend to be homes in communities where there is a larger percentage of people from BAME backgrounds. So we are not going to achieve net zero carbon very easily if we don't take those communities and that building stock on the journey with us. Their percentage is quite large. So we're not going to achieve UK being net zero by 2050 or earlier if we're not inclusive in the net zero journey to all parts of society. And that's when it becomes really tangible. That's when you realize actually there is a convergence of these issues. And those communities are living in those relatively poorer housing because there's perhaps a systemic issue that is forcing them to remain in those neighborhoods as opposed to going into neighborhoods which are bigger houses that are perhaps more efficient. And it's also those communities, incidentally, that are therefore due to density of urbanization are perhaps suffering most during this pandemic as well. And so there is a real collision of these issues that we need to recognize, and then we need to collaborate to resolve very quickly. Otherwise, we won't reach net zero. And I hope that's the sort of rounding up that you were hoping for.
No, appreciate that. You know, we could talk about this subject for hours, but I'm going to call it to a close there. Hopefully I can get you back and we can talk about what's going on at Cambridge because we didn't manage to touch on that. And I think that that's fascinating as well. And there's a lot of good things coming out of what's going on there that would be interesting. So Manish, I really appreciate your time and all your insights and look forward to talking to you again soon.
A real pleasure, Michael. Thank you for the opportunity.